You've dialed into the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm John Williams. Wednesdays, Terry Savage joins us. Hi, Terry. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So a few things are on people's minds today. And I know one of the things that a lot of people were paying attention to yesterday was giving on Tuesday. You got any wisdom for us on that topic?
Well, it's not too late to give on Wednesday or any day before the end of the year. You know, most people don't itemize their tax returns anymore because of they've done away with state and local tax deductions and so forth. But still, Americans give a lot. And so I'll give three quick points. Number one, if you're going to give, give wisely. It's not necessarily the mailings you get or the commercials you see late at night. In fact, those charities might be spending a lot of their money on advertising and less on the good cause. So go to charitynavigator.org, either to check out a charity, see what percent of their fundraising goes to the actual cause, or for ideas. If it's a disease research you want to support or a cause, you can look up some great charities there. Second thing is, charity begins at home. Let's start with your children and grandchildren. This is the perfect time of year to contribute to a 529 plan. Most of our listeners are in Illinois, not all of them, but you could contribute to any plan in any state. Illinois residents get a tax deduction for contributions to Bright Start on their Illinois state taxes, up to $10,000. But the good news is, Bright Start was just given one of the five Gold Star ratings by Morningstar. So they've made it even more efficient, better investment choices. So just go to brightstart.com. This is one thing you do not do through a broker or a financial planner and pay any kind of fees. Go directly yourself. If one child doesn't use it, another child can. And if your child gets scholarships at the end when they get employed, they can even roll some of that money into a Roth IRA. So it's a gift that keeps on giving. Very small minimum contributions. Just get the child's social security number. The grandparent can be the custodian. The parent, it doesn't matter. There could be more than one account for that child. So if you as a grandparent want to keep yours separate, that's fine. What else can I tell you? Oh, yeah. If you haven't, please take your required minimum distribution now. I mean, you only have a couple weeks. There's holidays in there from your IRAs. And if you want to contribute directly to a charity from your IRA, it can count against that required minimum distribution. So if you're one of the fortunate people that says, I don't really want to take this money out, and the government says, but you must, we need our taxes, you can say, give X amount of it anyway to this charity directly. Your fund custodian, IRA custodian, must give it directly to a registered charity. It can count against your RMD and you won't pay taxes on that.
Mm. By the way, back to the first point you were making about the fact that most Americans, 9 in 10, don't itemize anymore because you said state and local taxes aren't deductible anymore. Didn't they raise the value of the standard deduction?
Oh, yeah, and the standard deduction is higher, right? For most people, it doesn't pay to go through that whole long process of itemizing deductions. And charities, when they did that, were very concerned that they would lose contributions. But Americans are still the most giving and charitable people on the planet. So it's not about taxes only.
Although it is, and I remember for years, Brenda and I would always keep an envelope with all of the receipts.
Uh-huh.
And then if you donated clothes to the local pantry or something like that, they would give you an empty receipt and then you could put in the value, which was, for me, usually around $9,000 I put down.
No. If it's that much money, you have to get an expert comparable opinion or sales if you're going to donate something.
It was pretty funny how that worked out, though, where it was sort of it was fudgeable to some degree, but you had to have the real receipts. And now that whole bookkeeping thing is kind of over for just about everybody.
Exactly. They said they were going to make it simpler. What they did is do away with a lot of deductions so they can get at your money for taxes. That's a whole other story.
Oh, really? You think that, in fact, then we're not coming out ahead on this?
I'm not so sure that many people are coming out ahead, except for the fact that you don't have as much tax, prep work.
Well, that is something, though, isn't it?
Oh, that's a lot to be said for that.
Terry Savage, the money lady, is on a line, and she mentioned RMDs. We've got some questions about that, Terry. Can you take a call or two?
Sure, delighted.
Okay, then we'll start with Kathy. You're on WGN with Terry Savage. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Hi, Terry. I followed you for 100 years.
I've been around for 100 years.
You explain things so clearly. I'm turning 73 next year, So I have those god-awful RMDs, and it makes me a little nervous because I have a very small nest egg. But there's no way of getting around it that I'm understanding unless you do the charity thing. But I see these things on Instagram like, pay less for your RMDs, la, la, la. So I'm just wondering if I'm missing anything, if there's something smart I should do.
You're not missing anything. You are going to take an RMD next year, the year you turn 73, but it is going to be based on the value of your IRA or several IRAs at the end of this year. So number one, to everybody who's in this RMD stage, keep your January statement. It shows your December 31st balance. If you have three IRAs, you know, just keep those statements, add them all up. That's your main number. You can actually calculate in January what your RMD will be. There's a column up at Terry Savage on how to calculate your RMD. There's an online calculator, or your custodian at Fidelity or Vanguard you'll say, look, I have 36,000 here and 71,000 there and 149. And the total is, what's my RMD? I'm going to be 73 years old this week. They will be able to tell you when you give them that number. You can take it out all in January. You could take out a couple thousand dollars every month during the year. Remember to make sure they withhold taxes, or you're going to wind up with a tax bill next spring. And there's no way to get around that. Now, nobody says you have to spend it. So, number one, you could just put it in a money market account and keep saving it. It'll be after tax savings. Or if you're still working, you can make a contribution for that year no matter what anyway.
But wait a minute. So the only purpose then of an RMD is so the government can tax it?
Yeah, exactly. The government wants to get its hands on your tax dollars.
And that's a national law. There's not certain states.
That's the IRS. That's federal.
But I mean, it isn't. But
we do not tax in Illinois. We don't have state taxes.
But you've just reinforced, I think, in our minds, Terry. Again, maybe it's obvious, but the only thing then that you lose is the tax on that, if in fact you want to invest it. And if you've paid 20% on that money as a tax, you can get 5% back on it anyway. I mean, you don't have to spend the money, is the point.
You don't have to. It's not a law that says you have to spend the money. And if you're thinking my nest egg is shrinking, well, you'll pay the taxes on it, whatever tax bracket you're in. But you do want to have them do some withholding from it. And then you can put the money in a money market, just regular money market account.
Well, is there the danger that you'll invest that money then in something that eventually you'll have to pay taxes on down the road?
Well, yeah, but that should be your biggest problem. That means you had big gains. Most people who take money out of their IRA and say, I don't want to spend it, but you're forcing me to do it, are probably in the position where they say, God, I don't want to risk it either, so I'll just put it in the bank.
Right. So if you put it in a bank that at least gives you 5%, or in CDs, you can
4.5%. You can get about 4.5% in 6-month treasury bills today. Yeah. But no, there's no way around it. And there's big penalties if you don't do it. So a reminder, and I'm going to do this in January. I'm on all the time. I'm going to say your year end statements are coming from your IRAs. Put them in a big paperclip. Get the bottom line. Total them all up. That's your level from which during the year at some point you'll have to take the RMD.
And what percentage is that? Is it the same for everybody?
It changes. No, well, what it depends on is your age and the amount of money you have in your account.
There's a table I can look at, and it'll
tell
me.
There's a link for RMD calculator right on my website in that. Just go under columns and write RMD. When you search my columns, it'll give you the link to the calculator. So if you get all your statements January 18th, 19th, whenever they show up, put them together. This is what I do, because over the years I had multiple IRAs because I wanted to get all the material from all the different mutual fund companies. So you just add those balances up, and then you start figuring out.
And at what age do you have to? At what age do you have to?
And you could take it out of one account or some out of every account.
I've heard you say that, but at what age do I have to start doing RMDs?
If you're 73 that year, that's your first year.
Oh.
And you want to do it the year you turn 73. You could postpone it till the taxes are due the next year, but then you'll have two RMDs, and that'll mess up your Medicare premiums and so forth. So just take the RMD the year you turn 73.
So, Terry, just for historical perspective, I didn't learn of these until a few years ago. When did they start instituting this, and when did they... Is it that big of a budget thing, a revenue thing, that they have to force?
Yeah, it is. Well, they've actually they increased the age. It used to be 70 and a half, and then it went to 72, And then it went to 73. And if you wait long enough, I think it's 2035, it'll go to age 75 to take your RMDs.
It just seems sad that the government forces you to take your money out and pay taxes on it. Why can't you just keep it? Who said that?
Well,
they
you
should have power over that?
You could pay. Are you kidding me? Who says the IRS should have power over everything you earn?
No, I get her point. I get her point. She doesn't like this little maneuver we have to make.
But you got tax deferred growth.
You did get tax deferred growth. That's
you got tax deferred growth for all these years. You didn't pay on the gains. You didn't pay on the dividends. You don't get capital gains, which you would get if you were investing outside one of these accounts. But you got all the money to grow and compound.
But the
tax deferred.
Okay, but the reason they did that was so that we could have some money to retire on. And Kathy's here saying that given a limited amount of resources to retire on, there's the government with their hand out again.
Everybody gets a vote.
Well, duh, John. Yeah, we all know that. Kathy, welcome to the 73 Club.
Thanks and no thanks.
I'm not there yet, but I think that's very helpful, Terry. Hey, Terry, I don't understand squat about RMDs, says this listener. I inherited my parents' IRAs, and their fund management company has been less than helpful. I know how much I have to take out, but what am I supposed to do with it? I don't understand.
Your fund management company should be very, very helpful about this. First of all, it all depends on when your parents passed away and what the rules are then that apply. It used to be you could roll it over into your own IRA and stretch it out until you needed to take the money out. But now you have 10 years to withdraw the money. So a lot of it depends on when when your parents passed away, when you inherited it, but you need to follow the strict rules. You can roll over this IRA, this inherited IRA. And if you do a search at terrysavage.com, left side is columns. And if you put the word rollover in the column search, it will show you exactly how to roll over. So if you're at some place where they're not paying attention to you, you can have it directly rolled over to Fidelity or Vanguard, where, believe me, they're more than happy to help you decide how, teach you how much you have to take out and when you have to wipe out that IRA within 10 years, likely.
We're out of time, Terry.
Next week, I'll give you the full hour. I have to go to a board meeting today. I love the time I spend with you, John.
Is that BORED or BOAR?
It's a corporate board meeting for CME Group, and they hit on Wednesdays sometimes, unfortunately.
We always appreciate your help. Thank you, Terry Savage.
Thanks, John.
TerrySavage.com, the nationally syndicated financial columnist. An hour with her next week. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. You're listening to WGN Radio. Emily Stewart joins us again, senior correspondent writing about business and the economy at BusinessInsider.com. Today, talking about on-the-job training. Who's getting it and how good is it? Hi, Emily. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, who's getting it and how good is it?
I mean, I think that this is kind of an age-old problem, that people really feel like they're not ready when it comes to work. You know, as much as you hear about Gen Z workers not knowing what they're doing, a lot of HR professionals and Gen Z will tell you, no, the problem is that I'm not getting training. We see that a lot of workers say that they really want mentorship, they want training, and they're not getting it. And we also see that middle managers are also really stressed, and they say, listen, I'd love to spend time training people, but I don't have time. And especially in a moment where kind of a lot of the job of training has gone by the wayside, when training employees is kind of everybody's job, it winds up being nobody's job.
Yeah. I presume this is at larger companies, right? I mean, if it's a mom and pop shop, a store, maybe a independent retail establishment, it seemed to me that the owner or manager is right there. But if you're in a suite of offices, maybe you get lost in the shuffle, huh?
Right. I mean, I do think if you're in a smaller environment, you know, if it's just you working at a deli and the manager, like obviously you're going to get better training. So a lot of this is kind of a bigger organization, but like you said, maybe it's a giant office. And you don't really, you know, everybody's kind of a faceless person, or you're working hybrid, or you're working remote, and you don't even kind of know where to begin. And, you know, you have to think about, too, a lot of work is learning by osmosis. Now, that doesn't mean that remote work means nobody's getting on the job training, but it is different, and it has to be deliberate. And, you know, when you talk to people in HR, when you talk to people in training, and honestly, when you talk to workers, what you hear is like, I want to learn, I just don't know how. And like, there's just not really a holistic plan to train mm-hmm. workers, to onboard workers. And sometimes you also don't realize that people don't know what they're doing until it's kind of not too late, yeah. but until a moment comes up where all of a sudden you need something urgently. And, you know, holy moly, this person that's been on for 3 months actually has no idea. And they didn't know they didn't know.
Yeah, right. I mean, you can't know what you don't know. If you don't know, you should know it. Did you speak, though, about the complication of hybrid, and you say that's not an excuse, though, in your story.
Yeah, I mean, when I talk to a lot of HR professionals and people in charge of training, you know, it's easy to say, well, it's all just remote, and if people come into the office, that would be fine. But they said, no, like, you really do need... You need a plan, and maybe it means with hybrid and remote, you do need to kind of be a little bit more intentional about it and more deliberate. But even if you are starting a job, I think nowadays in the office, you know, I started a new job at the beginning of the year, and I went to the office at first, and it doesn't mean I wasn't sitting with training video. You know, I think that technology has, in, you know, in part of ways, a solution here, right, whether or not you're hybrid or you are in the office, that it's great that you have these training modules, that you have videos. At the same time, I think a lot of companies are really throwing technology at the problem and saying, well, this will fix it. And just because you have a training software, because you have a mentoring software, doesn't mean people are going to use it, doesn't mean people are going to look at it, doesn't mean people understand that way. And I think that is, or, you know, learn that way. And I think that isn't just a remote problem. I think that's always a problem.
I didn't realize that. So is that what happens? A new hire gets some software that will... They'll click through and learn, or they're given a series of videos. We get that from our HR department here each year, a series of videos, but they're more compliance than training videos. But it's the same sort of thing, you're saying?
Yeah, a lot of companies, it is like that. You know, I talked to one person who had started a job earlier this year, and it wasn't something that she wasn't super familiar with. It was, you know, an account management job, but pretty heavily science-focused, and she was honest. I don't have a science background. And she just got mounds and mounds of training videos, very little follow-up. And after, you know, a matter of weeks, the company came to her and said, we don't think you're picking this up. And she kind of thought, well, wait, I'm sitting with these training videos. Not everybody learns that way necessarily. And she was supposed to go to meetings afterwards where other coworkers were supposed to show up, and those people weren't showing up. And again, kind of like I said before, part of the problem here, too, is that middle managers have been cut out. And so there isn't someone whose job it is to train people. And I think a lot of the time, too, the problem is also that if you are a middle manager and, you know, you either have to show up to a meeting with your bosses higher up, or you have to teach somebody under you how to do something, you're going to show up to that meeting with the higher ups because that's the person who ultimately is in charge of you having a job, your paycheck.
Well, you'd think that it's so counterproductive and so intuitive that if you don't train your people, they're not going to be productive, and nobody wins in that case. You would think that the middle managers who are maybe absent, or at least not there in sufficient numbers, or the higher-ups still would see this and would do something about it. They would apply a human touch to it. What is happening, or what are some suggestions here?
I mean, I do think part of the issue is just there are some kind of misaligned incentives. What one person I was talking to mentioned to me is that a lot of the time in the way companies are measuring performance, they're not really measuring, you know, training, or they're not measuring, you know, let's say I work somewhere for 5 years and a new coworker comes to me and says, hey, I don't know how to do this. If I spend 10 minutes with that person, that's not kind of helping me. And so there's just kind of a misalignment of incentives. You know, I do think the biggest kind of takeaway for me when talking with people who have been successful is you have to be deliberate, and you really kind of have to make this a priority, at least for someone in the organization. I talked to one woman with her company. They were, you know, kind of small, agile company. They were growing. They really started to grow over the past few years, and they realized that, again, they were having these new hires that they thought had an idea of what was going on, and suddenly a client needs something, and it turns out these people have no idea what they're doing because they haven't been trained. And she'd really taken the reins. They'd also decided, okay, she's going to be in charge of training. She's going to really think through what this needs to look like. And so you just need, you know, one or two people to say, okay, it makes sense to invest the time and money in making sure that people know how to do their jobs, because, as you said, it's better for everyone in the long run. It's just easy, you know, when people are really stretched, when budgets are stretched, to kind of leave that to the side. And again, mm-hmm. a lot of the time you really don't know.
It seemed to me like if you had the resources, or maybe you created the resources, you would designate, maybe even hire, a person who is sort of a jack of all trades, that is competent in all of the departments to the degree that they could, almost like quality control, make sure they're running efficiently, or guide new hires. You could float around, and then they've got that roving mentor if you've got a question. There's a couple people like that at our company, I would say, that I turn to, and I go, well, what's happening here? How does this work? What do I need to do? And that's not their sole responsibility, but they've sort of come to that responsibility. I don't know if they, maybe they should get a little spiff for it. I don't know, but I wonder if companies are thinking along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big question is, like, it's yes. I mean, I think the obvious answer from the outside is to say, yes, you need to invest resources in this. You need to invest money in this. But that's a decision that a company has to come to. And again, I think especially in an age when there is kind of an app for everything, there's a technology for everything, it's really easy to think, well, I got this app, I got this technology, I'm sure that's fixing the problem. Not really look at if that's fixing the problem.
Yeah. I just hate that notion of, well, there's software, just look at your computer screen or watch this video, when they know you're struggling, or they should know you're struggling. It would seem to me like a live human being should help you. 630 texts to say, my son just left a job because he said no one would help him. Nobody wanted to take the time to teach. 847, I just left a relatively new job because people were mean and they didn't want to help. They were afraid of the competition I represented at work. Wow. This is a thing, huh?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. Yeah. I mean, I do think this is what a lot of people have had that experience with. And I think the big question now is, does it get better? You know, does it become, well, there's an AI solution to this. And it doesn't mean AI can't be part of the solution, but you worry sometimes.
Okay. Emily Stewart, senior correspondent, writing about this at businessinsider.com. On-the-job training is broken. That hurts companies and workers, she says. Nice to talk to you today, Emily. Thank you.
Thank you.
More business news now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The Centers for Disease Control says the E. coli outbreak at McDonald's is officially over. No new cases have been reported. The outbreak was likely caused by fresh slivered onions at McDonald's and sickened 104 people in 14 states. CDC says the actual number of people affected probably won't ever be known because some of those who were sickened never sought medical treatment or were never tested for E. coli. Bolingbrook-based ATI Physical Therapy has been delisted from the New York Stock Exchange for not maintaining a global market capitalization of at least $15 million. ATI's Class A common stock will now trade on the OTC Pink Market. The transition to the over-the-counter market is not expected to affect the company's business operations. ATI says it's in discussions to obtain interim financing to provide a near-term opportunity for stockholders to obtain liquidity. The company's CEO says despite the delisting, she's confident in ATI's strategic plan. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of food now. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And here's a confession you don't hear every day on the radio.
I soiled my undies.
Oh, okay. And you, too?
Yes, I soiled my undies.
Well, more about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. And there's never been a better time to soil your undies.
Yep, I soil my undies for a good cause. The understanding of soil health in and agriculture in the state of Illinois.
That's Irmán Bolero, the dean of the College of Aces at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And to clarify, soiling your undies means that you bury your underwear in the soil.
The project is called Soil Your Undies Campaign.
That's Sarah Caper.
And I am the Ag in the Classroom Director at the Champaign County Farm Bureau Foundation.
And Soiling Your Undies is all about teaching kids about soil health.
Our job is to take agriculture into the classrooms.
I'm guessing kids are having a lot of fun with this one, and it gets their attention.
It really does. When you pull out the pair of underwear, they're all curious about what you're going to do with it.
What they do is bury it.
It actually ties into the lesson that we've been teaching in local classrooms about fibers and farmers that raise our fibers that become our clothing.
The tidy whities are buried in the ground and left there till next spring, and when they are pulled out of the ground, if the soil is healthy with good microbe activity?
The microbes are going to consume the cotton fibers.
Holy underwear.
Yes, the synthetic waistband will be a surprise because it will still be intact.
And Dean Bolero at the U of I ACES says if your undies are not chewed up when you pull them out,
You probably have to do something to improve the soil health.
You can get in on the fun, too.
Yes, buy 100% cotton underwear, dig an 8-inch hole, bury the underwear in the hole, cover it up, and wait all winter, at least 4 months, and then dig it back up and see what has happened to it.
And then you, too, can tell the world,
I soiled my undies.
On the food calendar, it's National Cookie Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Sarah Foster, economic analyst at Bankrate. But there's a but to this, right, Sarah? Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, John. Always great to be here.
So what's the caveat to, what do you know, 3 in 5 of us got a raise this year?
Yeah, the caveat is probably how it's a good time to be an employed worker, but it's kind of a tougher time to be unemployed and on the job hunt, or even just someone who's working and looking for a change. You know, the job market isn't falling off a cliff. It's pretty stable, but we're also seeing that hiring is slowing. Many companies aren't really expanding their payrolls just yet. And that was part of the reason why we saw that the share of workers who got a pay increase by finding a better paying job fell to a series low of 20% this year.
Hmm. Well, what's inflation? About 4%. I wonder, too, how many people got a raise of 4% or more. I mean, that would be a COLA, essentially. I don't know that everybody's getting 4%, though.
Yeah, what's interesting is not just looking at the prevalence of wage increases, but how big those wage increases are, because we're continuing to see that workers are saying that their pay has not kept pace with rising expenses. Even half of those who received a pay increase say that their wages are still trailing inflation. And of course, economists would point out just how much inflation has slowed over the past 12 months. And you know, it's a little bit interesting here that roughly the same amount of workers who got a raise this year are saying that their pay is trailing inflation compared to last year. But of course, as we've talked about, you and I together on the show before, you know, Americans aren't really looking at that year over year inflation rate. They're really remembering how much prices surged from the beginning. And then, of course, how much they're still feeling that.
Sure. Well, for a couple of months, it was 9%, and that's the number that keeps getting kicked around. And it is cumulative. That doesn't go away. But at some point, it seems to me like America's psyche or politicians or economy needs to let that thing go. I mean, that happened. And I think it matters how we talk about or how we measure our economy. Inflation is just one component of it, and it's the most personal one, I know. But I think at some point we're talking about a number that happened a few years ago, and we don't have a wayback machine. We can't fix that.
It's absolutely true that periods of high inflation can impact just that psychological feeling that consumers have. Research has even shown that the Americans who really remembered that era in the 1980s when inflation was, of course, even worse than it was today, that altered their inflation expectations for the rest of their lives, where they always kind of assumed that prices were higher than they were. It's interesting, and I kind of wonder, you know, as a lot of us pay attention to what's happening in the job market, expecting you know, a continued gradual slowdown, of course, nothing remotely cracking, but more of a slowdown in the job market. I wonder how much that could impact consumer sentiment as well.
312-981-7200. If you got a raise, tell me how much. And I hope it's 10% or 100%. I don't know what it is. I'm just curious what our listeners will text in to say. You say that men are more likely than women to have found a better paying job in the last year, right?
Yeah, that was one of those interesting demographic differences that we noticed, in addition to younger generations and then lower income workers, too.
More than half of those making $100,000 a year or more, 57%, and workers making between $50,000 and $80,000 got a pay raise at their current job. Are you saying that the more money you make, the more likely it is you got a raise? higher up the food chain at the company?
I think one thing that could be happening here is that when you trace back demand for the jobs, where I guess the bulk of the demand still exists for hiring is within those lower income service sectors. So that's probably where those traditionally lower paying jobs, workers there in food services, leisure and hospitality, they're still taking advantage of this job hopping market. Whereas those higher income Americans who might be at those traditional white collar positions where companies are drastically slowing hiring plans and even maybe laying some of those individuals off in the industry, they're the ones who are staying put and just getting a raise at their current position.
I suppose as the economy prospers, too, a lot of people's compensation's tied to sales or the performance of the company. That's not maybe a raise, but I think a lot of people might be seeing an increase that way, too, right?
It's true. And we've asked this in previous years. We didn't look at that this year. But historically, the main way that Americans who get a raise get it is by getting a promotion,
yeah,
or some sort of performance-based compensation. Those cost of living adjustments are actually a little bit more rare.
312-981-7200. Tell me what you got this year as a percent, if you got anything at all. Pete just handed me a list of numbers and names. We'll get to that after the news. And we'll call on you another day, Sarah. Sarah Foster, economic analyst at Bankrate.com. Thank you.
Great to be here as always.